several years in the field of parapsychology, using physics to try to understand the science of it. Parapsychology is a field of science. Physics uses math to translate the natural things of the universe into a language which some people can understand. And then parapsychology, of course, is a study of the sixth sense of man. Now, the majority of the people doing research in parapsychology are physicists. There are some psychologists, but usually the psychologists have had psychic experiences before they become involved in psychic phenomena. And the peculiar thing is, it looks like the majority of psychologists that the field of parapsychology came out of are skeptical about there being such a thing as parapsychology. Some physics experiments conducted by physicists and parapsychology experiments unknown to the experimenter are actually experiments of parapsychology type. The experimenter thinks he's running an experiment of physics, but he's got his own thoughts, things going into it from the parapsychology realm that he's not aware of. And psychics are attempting to perform parapsychology experiments before skeptics, such as Randy the Magician, who was mentioned in the first talk here at our meetings, are successful in demonstrating that Randy the Magician is a psychic who can perform or prevent psychic occurrences. Now, of course, this is my opinion based on the idea that psychic phenomena is a natural phenomena, like physics, chemistry, biology, anything like that. It's something that goes on in the human brain. It's a physical thing going on in the human brain, and that there's a physical signal that travels from person to person, and from person to thing, and from things to people. Communication type signal. Any feat, no matter how impossible, such as flying, going to the moon, and building free energy machines, can be done when a sufficient number of people believe it, thus overcoming the skeptics who don't believe it. That's just philosophical more than anything else. I can't prove that, but that seems to be the implication from the way from history, as well as from the study I made of what parapsychology is. Many apparent impossible feats are accomplished by a few psychics, inventors, preachers, prophets, and others, but these feats then become impossible when enough people believe they're impossible. I think you see the connection here between what I'm talking about and the religious term faith. The physicists ask, what are the causes and effect in an experiment? What are the boundary conditions? How do you make sure you are repeating the same experiment each time you conduct an experiment? And knowing these conditions are the only way you can repeat an experiment in any of the sciences. Parapsychology is so new, we know so little about it, that we don't know the boundary conditions of any experiment that's ever been run yet. There are assumptions made about boundary conditions, but it's very unlikely these cover the total description of the experiment. The human brain exerts a minute force on objects outside the brain. That's a known fact of parapsychology at this time. And in a previous ASA meeting, I told the group, and I don't think any of you were here, about affecting an experiment that was being conducted at Princeton when I was in Huntsville. Now, after telling that experiment I conducted, without knowing the boundary conditions, of course, when I conducted it, I assumed that I probably would be very less successful in conducting that experiment again, because the majority of the people who heard me in that ASA meeting were very skeptical that such a thing could be done. And incidentally, that I had a follow-up to that experiment, which I did some 3 years ago, just before this meeting. I received a call from a lady who dabbles in the psychic. She calls herself a spiritualist this time, I think. She said she'd been to a meeting in Texas in which she had talked to Brenda Dunn, who is conducting the experiments at Princeton, and asked Brenda if she knew me, and Brenda said, yes, he's the fellow who fouled us up on that experiment we were conducting and on the cascade random number generator. And they assumed at Princeton, they knew what I had done, but both the two experimenters I've talked to both assumed that I did do what I said that I thought I had done in affecting their experiment at a distance. Now, non-repeatability occurs in experiments which are affected by very small forces, such as measuring the velocity of the light or the wave nature of light. When physicists conduct experiments that involve very low forces, the physicists get variations in their data. And they always have that experimental error figured in, and the range of the numbers, how the plus minus turns on their numbers because of these variations. And in quantum mechanics, things like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, various other things that tell you that if you know some data, you can't know other data. Some facts, you can't know other facts. Now, where there are large forces involved in things we do, such as going to the moon, and I keep referring to these things that I've been involved in, even though many people may believe you can't do it, their negative thoughts don't have sufficient force, if there is such a thing, to overcome the actual forces that are involved, the actions going on. I don't mean just the thrust of a space vehicle as it takes off, but the actions of all of those people who do believe that it can be done are willing to try it anyway if they're paid to do their job, you see. Now, in this Challenger 7 tragedy, I looked at that sort of philosophically, and I couldn't help but wonder how much of that failure was due to the physical failure of hardware and how much was due to the thinking of people, the negative thoughts of people. We know that some engineers, quite a few engineers, didn't have much confidence in the O-rings that failed in the Challenger 7. I knew that before I retired from NASA. I knew there was a problem with that hardware. And the Thiokol engineers who designed the O-rings didn't have confidence in them. And in addition to those specific people who knew there was a specific problem, there were millions of people who have this feeling, like myself, that sooner or later there's going to be a failure. And we were still all amazed. How many of you thought there would probably be a failure here somewhere along the way? This was just too much to believe that it could go on, that NASA wouldn't have a major failure somewhere along the way. Well, one reason I kept watching, anticipating an explosion somewhere along the way, I'd seen so many of them in the early days of rocketry, particularly at the Cape on the Vanguard that I was on for a while. So how much of the failure was due to mechanical hardware and how much was psychic, we don't know. But one of the interesting things is the vehicle before this one would have failed if it had been launched on the day before they actually launched it. They were attempting to launch. They couldn't launch because of the weather. And when they checked it out, there was a failure in the engine, which would have caused a catastrophic failure of the vehicle if it had occurred in flight. Now, that was an act of God, you might say, that prevented that particular catastrophic failure. Totally different area than the O-rings. Now, I reminisce some because of various things that have occurred, wondering how much is psychic in a lot of these, like on the Vanguard. When the first Vanguard was launched, I was a propulsion engineer on the second stage, and I knew there were engineering problems with the second stage. It hadn't been corrected, so I wrote a memo to my supervisor recommending that 11 items be taken care of before we attempted to launch. It was too risky, I felt like, to try to launch it. But they went ahead and launched anyway, and out of these 11 items, four caused failures and the others were corrected before they did. Then then in addition to my attitude or engineering judgment, let's say, about the Vanguard, the propulsion engineer on the first stage also knew of problems. First stage failed first. It had the first chance and failed. In any case, you really wonder then how much of these types of failures are caused by the thinking itself, being confident that a thing is going to happen, and how much is really caused by the hardware. Or it's really hardware, but it's a hardware partially affected by the thinking of people that way. We normally think in a religious sense that faith deals with non-material things to a large degree. Now, following these Vanguard failures, at another time when I was responsible for a rocket engine at Pratt Whitney in Florida, in reviewing the status of that when I first came on the program, I recommended to my supervisor that they not try to conduct qualification test on it because it looked like it would be about to have all the bugs worked out. It would really go through a qualification test successfully. I didn't specifically predict that it was going to fail in any memo or anything like that, but I did say that it couldn't go through a qualification program. On the day they started the official qualification program, my supervisor, an Air Force colonel who was actually responsible for it at that time, and many other people were watching. When the engine started, it blew up the test stand. So it was another case of engineering judgment. How much was engineering judgment? How much was that confidence or feeling or whatever? Now, following that, I was already working at Marshall Space Flight Center for Ron Braun and his group at that time. I checked my records, and I could find no cases where I ever expected or predicted a failure of any vehicle, and I was working propulsion and vehicle in the first stage of the Saturn V. I had confidence in the vehicles because every engineering problem we knew of was always worked out before we tried to launch. It was the policy. And however, when we started the shuttle program, I was having lunch with another engineer responsible for the IUS, the interim upper stage, which he had no confidence in, problems, technical problems. And when the first one of these was launched on April 4th, 1983, I was observing the launch on TV and had a feeling and turned to a person next to me and I said, they're going to have trouble with the IUS on this. Just one of those things I say once in a while for some reason or other. And that IUS did fail to launch the TDRS satellite that was supposed to launch it. The TDRS satellite did manage to get into orbit, but it was not, the propulsion system fell way short of what it was supposed to in getting it there. Then another prediction, which didn't deal with the failure at all, was Apollo 11, and I wasn't making a prediction, but it was one of those interesting things which occurred, in which Senator Harold Hughes, he was then the governor of Iowa, and his campaign manager, Gene Kiefer, predicted that the way Kiefer said it, he said the astronauts will encounter God. The astronauts will meet God or encounter God. And I thought he meant they're going to be killed. And he said, no, not that. They're just going to have a religious awakening or a spiritual awakening or some unusual spiritual experience. And I checked with Harold Hughes to see if he agreed with that, and he did. Not only that, he told me some other things that were rather interesting and unusual for a governor to be involved in, but he's an unusual person. Well, you know what happened on Apollo 11. That's the first one that went to the moon, circle the moon, and it made the trip over the Christmas holidays. There was a reading of the Bible and these other things that were quite unusual from a religious or spiritual viewpoint. And this material I've covered as a chapter in a book I'm presently working on. And the material, the major part of it, was either written down and or told to other people prior to the launch of that vehicle. Now, in parapsychology, I'm assuming that there are signals. The test data has indicated that people's brain does exert a force, therefore apparently something must be traveling or going from a person's brain to an object. I've been working on the specific physics, trying to define what that is, and I've prepared two papers, one in the field of relativity, using a gravitational pulse, as defining this as a gravitational pulse. The other one is a paper in quantum mechanics in which I define it as a electrostatic pulse. I feel it's both, and the stronger signal should be the electrostatic pulse. An atomic bomb going off produces an electrostatic pulse, a very big, powerful pulse. Every time a photon leaves that light up there, I'm proposing it produces an electrostatic pulse. Each photon leaving produces this very minute electrostatic force, and the professors who've reviewed my two papers tend to agree with me that I'm on the right track. But in my physics papers, I do not deal with parapsychology in any way at all. It's purely physics, just reporting on experiments that have been done, the data obtained, and why there are some unanswered questions in their data. Now, the brain has many energy level transitions. That's the functioning of the brain, the production of signals. Neurons are constantly operating. They never quit, and they're always producing these signals. We pick up a macroscopic quantity of this signal with EEG, electroencephalograph, our brain waves. That's an electrical signal that results from these much weaker signals in the brain. Now, what I suspect happens is in the processes in the brain, specifically ionization and or the transfer of an ion across a synaptic cleft, this energy level transition produces the electrostatic pulse because it's a charged particle. It's proceeding through an electrostatic field, electromagnetic field. And you know, it is electrostatic field. And that pulse is the primary thing that people can pick up from brain to brain, and which I found was the easiest way to pick up signals, pick up information. It seemed to be always easier to pick it up from people than I could from things. Now, relating this to religion is just an opinionated type thing, of course. If you look at things like supernatural from a physicist's viewpoint, you change the supernatural term or say that supernatural would be just things that a writer didn't understand. They're way beyond him, and he thought they were in a special realm. Today, or in my case, I just consider them natural and things not understood at that time. So in that case, the miracles of the Bible, if you look at it from that viewpoint, all miracles of the Bible could be accounted for as natural events, not understood by the people there, particularly in the field of parapsychology. They seem to be almost always either purely parapsychology or the use of that by higher intelligence or more advanced beings or whatever you may want to use for scientific terms for those angels of the Bible, God of the Bible, such as that. And I've covered all of this about the Bible in two books which I published quite a few years ago. That covers pretty well the primary material that I wanted to get into, and if you would like for me to cover any of this in more detail, I'm open for questions.
Any questions? I have a question. Did you say that you are able to pick up and measure the energy emanation from the human brain?
Yes, the electroencephalograph can pick up the brain waves. There's the primary one you can pick up is the alpha rhythm brain wave, about 8 to 16 cycles per second. It's the irregular electrical.
And how's that picked up?
Well, I'm not that familiar with the electroencephalograph. It's something doctors use when they're running a physical.
EKG, I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. The EEG is what this is. Yes, it's same as the EKG as far as I know, except it's on the head rather than on parts of the body.
Does that pick up emanation or electrical impulses, electrical impulses in the brain?
I think that's what's going on in the brain rather than
it picks up what's going on in the brain, but it has to be at the surface before this can pick it up. It's I guess it's picking up electrostatic variations.
What's going on in the brain? But is there any indication something can be radiated from the brain?
Oh, yes. It's just understood that if it's on the surface of the brain, it must be also beyond the surface of the brain.
But is it being picked up at some distance from the brain?
No, it's right on the surface of the brain. I mean on the surface of the skull.
Difference between picking it up on the surface and at some distance, whether it's leading or whether it's just...
Well, electrical signals like this always radiate.
The other person's thinking, and what they're thinking, does that affect the brain?
Not that we can detect, no. It's feelings, state of mind. The alpha rhythm is produced best when you're in a very relaxed, restful state, but alert. And when you start going to sleep, there's another brain wave when you begin to doze off. And I don't recall what that one is, or what the name for it is. The names for them. And the only difference in the waves are the frequency and the strength of the wave. We can tell nothing about thoughts as far as this is concerned.
One of the reasons I asked that question, we have a friend who lives in Pittsburgh, but here we are not playing Trivial Pursuit with him, or if we did play the thing, not to look at the answer. If you looked at the answer, he would get the answer.
Because of things that have happened at this meeting, let me make a comment about my opinion on people playing with the psychic. You know, that's the usual thing, or entertainment of the psychic nature. Found one person who was just very eager to find somebody who could do psychic things. Well, I know lots of people who can do psychic things, but I don't feel that you should waste your time with this unless you do it for some good reason. Now, I feel like my reason is satisfactory. I'm doing it for scientific purposes. And I actually did a lot of psychic things when I was trying to determine what was going on. But I stopped doing those primarily because it's not worthwhile. There's no particular advantage to it. I can pick up information on people that they don't want me to know. Well, I don't want to do that. That's an invasion of privacy. It's not very nice to people to do things of this type. When I was doing this, I got permission of people before I picked up on, in most cases, I picked up on people who were doing research in the field. So my advice, if you're interested in psychic, observe it objectively. Stand on the outside and take a look at it, but don't get involved in it. A lot of people are good at it when they first start. Most people are, as a matter of fact, children particularly. But if they start trying to rely on it, they're in trouble then, because it's not reliable. You may be psychic one time, you depend on it, and the next time you think you're psychic, you're not, and you're in trouble.
How do you correlate that with what the scripture says about witches and fears and so forth being an abomination to God? That it seems like there's some satanic element in it. Suck people in, and then you say it's not reliable, and then they get
into
trouble.
That just doesn't fit in with the work I'm doing in the psychic area. I'm not really concerned about whether this can be used for good and bad, just like anything else, you know. I'm just trying to determine what it is. And who produces it or how it's produced doesn't make any particular difference to me. It's still a physical phenomenon, something that can be investigated. Now, before I started this, I had a lot of concerns from a religious viewpoint and did a lot of praying, talking to God. The responses I obtained, the signs or whatever you may want to call them, were satisfactory from my viewpoint to go ahead with it. And the results I've gotten since that time has given me confidence that I understood correctly the signs.
You talk about what being so small and not being able to... Or you left the question about whether how much of these failures were due to just other mechanical errors and what people believe. Do you see any way of separating those two out? It's a nice theory, but there's no way that it's a provable theory,
right,
or accessible.
The thing, I've presented my concepts to NASA two times before I retired, once in Houston, one at MSFC, pointing out to them that in any type of experiment, hardware that involve very small forces, such as electrical signals, very weak electrical signals. And that's used throughout all of high technology hardware now, computers and such, use very low signals. But they should always take into account the possibility of the influence of people. There was a possibility of a problem there, and at least should be investigated and should be determined where the boundary is between people being able to influence it and the signal being strong enough so that people can influence it. That wasn't in the area of NASA's work, and so there was nothing done that way.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.